once a month I have to go on travel for the state of Oregon, so I do appreciate that. We're going to pick up tonight, and tonight is chapter 15 in the yellow section there. We're actually entering now. We are making progress. We're into the second cycle of discussions as Job continues to talk with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So we finished round one, and now we're actually getting into round two. And it actually goes three rounds, and then we have some other interludes, and then a young man by the name of Elihu speaks up. And so we're going to get through it probably by the end of May. And I'm feeling pretty good about this. We're making very good progress. I realize that it's very quick what we're covering, and we're just hitting highlights. So be sure and do the reading and bring any questions you have with you when you come in. Okay, we're going to go ahead and start in chapter 15, and I'm going to go ahead and ask for a reader. This is a long chapter, so I don't mind if we break it into half. If I could get someone to read verses 1 through 16, and then someone else to read verses 17 through 35. Okay, Kevin, you got 1 through 16. Bruce, you want to get 17 through 35, and then we'll go ahead and start taking some notes and some summaries on this chapter. Bruce.
Okay. I will tell you, listen to me, and what I have seen, I will also declare. What wise men have told and have not concealed from their father, to whom alone the land was given. And no alien passed among them. The wicked man arise and came all his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. Sounds of terror are in his ears, while at peace disorder comes upon him. He does not believe that he will return from the darkness, and he is destined for the sword. He wonders about for food, saying, where is it? He knows that a day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish terrify him. They overpower him like the king ready for the attack. Because he has stretched out his hand against God, he conducts himself arrogantly against the Almighty. He rushes headlong at him with his massive shield. For he has covered his face with his fat, and he has made his thighs heavy with flesh. He has lived in desolate cities, and in houses no one would inhabit, which are destined to be ruined. He will not become rich, nor will his wealth endure, and his gain will not bend down to the ground. He will not escape from the darkness, the flame will wither his shoots, and by the breath of his mouth he will go away. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself, for emptiness will be his reward. It will be accomplished before his time, and his palm branch will not be green. He will drop off his unripe grape like the vine, and will cast off his flower like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren. The fire consumes the tents of the corrupt. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity, and their mind prepares to.
Thank you, Bruce, and thank you, Kevin. Okay, we kick off round two here with Eliphaz, and he accuses Job of folly. I want you to notice a remarkable change here, too. Eliphaz, in the first cycle, in the first go-around, was very somewhat friendly and somewhat forbearing attitude, almost gentlemanly and kind in his first speech. And now he's been stung. And so Eliphaz now exhibits more of a harsh or more of a severe mood towards Job. He's disgusted. And he thinks Job is very sinful, and he's very disgusted with Job. If you look down in verse 3 there, in verses 2 and 3, the end of 2, he says, shall he fill himself with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches with which he can do no good? Eliphaz is personally hurt by Job's remarks. And the point I want you to understand here, Job, to him, is showing contempt for the wisdom and for the theology or philosophy of the ancients. And Eliphaz says he's full of the east wind, and that is actually a reference to a wind. It's called the Sirocco, and I've got it up there. It's S-I-R-O-C-C-O, which is a very vehement, hot east wind that blows. And so he's saying, basically, Job, you're full of hot air. You're like the Sirocco. You're full of this hot barbarous air, you know, very, very hot, humid air. And so that's what he's accusing Job of. In verse number 4, he says that basically that Job is stupid, and Job is now dangerous, and his words basically are a threat to what Eliphaz considers to be sound religion. And up to this point, if you look down at verses 5 and 6, you can see he makes references to all of the organs that we use in speech. He talks about the mouth. He talks about the lips. He talks about the tongue. And so up to this point, Job's friends have really failed to find any particular sins. They were just kind of shooting in the dark, taking shots at maybe it's this and maybe it's that. And now Eliphaz thinks he's really got something to pin on him, and that's Job's guilty speech, and hence the reference to the mouth, the lips, and the tongue. And so to him, this points out to really, really some deep-seated iniquity. Down in verses 7 through 10, Eliphaz asks questions here that really are intended to ridicule Job. And so these are kind of mocking as he asks them. So in verse 7, he asks, well, Job, if you're so smart, are you the firstborn of the human race? And so again, this is very, very mocking. Job, were you here before the mountains were created? Again, very mocking. If not, how could Job be so bold as to reject the wisdom, quote, of the ancients? Verses 8 and 9, he says, was Job privy to the secret counsel of the Almighty? Is wisdom limited to Job? What does Job know that they, all three friends, do not know? So these are very, very condescending type questions and intended to be mocking Job. Any thoughts on this before we move on? But very, very, this is done very, very mocking manner. Eliphaz reminds Job here in verse 10 that there's apparently a bigger audience than what we know. When we read the book of Job, we think the three friends and perhaps Elihu are there. This is one of those indication verses that there's a lot more company of people there. And because Eliphaz makes reference, he says, the gray-headed and the very aged men were with them. So there's a company of people here sitting with Job. And in fact, Eliphaz makes a reference, there's some that are even older than Job's father. So there were some elders that were there sitting during this whole thing as well. And I guess the point we need to understand is Job has never, ever, even up to this point in chapter 15 and all the way from the beginning, has never claimed or made any exaggerated claims of higher intelligence than his three friends. The only thing he did claim, that he claimed to be as intelligent as his friends, and he also claimed that he was innocent. BJ.
His statement that both the gray-haired and aged are among us older than your father, does it imply that there has to be a group of elders there? Or we always call them Job's friends, so we assume they're the same age as Job. Could this be that these would be men that have come to counsel Job because of their position and the fact that they're actually older than Job's father?
And that's possible too. Some of the commentaries read this as that Eliphaz was considering himself younger than these others, and so he's referring to the gray-headed and very aged. It could be that's just referring to the three friends. It seems to lean though towards there's possibly a bigger company that is witnessing all this than just the three plus Elihu. So we just don't know. But there seems to be, some of the commentary said it seems to refer to a little bit of a larger company there while this is all going on. Very interesting, when we get down to verses 11 through 16, Eliphaz points out some of God's consolations, and this is where he gets kind of braggadocious. Basically, he points out that the three friends themselves were there to teach and console Job because they were sent there from God. And so he's kind of patting himself on the back here that God's consolations were in the three friends themselves traveling all that distance and coming to talk with Job and teach Job and console Job. And as you have seen already, there's not a whole lot of consolation going on. There's a lot of accusation going on. And they're trying to teach Job that he's done something sinful. And so basically Eliphaz here is basically asking, are our words just too insignificant to you, Job, to be received by you? After all, we're speaking for Job. And so that's this very arrogant attitude that Eliphaz has. He takes it upon himself that they're there, they represent God, they are speaking for God, and so Job should listen and pay attention to what they have to say because they know the wisdom of the ancients. And you're going to hear that referenced over and over again.
They're coming from that initial position that you stated when we first started out. They believe that God is in charge of everything and that God punishes as well as rewards.
Exactly. And the mold that they're going to keep bouncing back to, and you're going to get tired of hearing this, but it keeps going back, is the orthodoxy view that they have of God and of theology is that wealthy men are blessed by God and are good people. Poor men and diseased men are cursed by God and are bad people. Nothing will allow them to break that mold. That's their theology. They do not and cannot accept that. And Job starts pointing out, oh really? And he starts pointing out examples where the poor and the evil men prosper and live to a long age. They just cannot accept that. They're just almost like, stopping their ears up. And so you're going to hear that cycle go back and forth because Job starts pointing out to real cases saying, no, this happens. The evil men prosper and good men sometimes suffer. And so Job starts realizing that suffering, the rain and the sunshine fall on all. And so we're gonna get to more and more of that as we keep going down, because these guys keep going back to their orthodoxical view that if you're blessed, you're good. If you're evil, then you suffer. And that's just their view. If you look at verses 12 and 13, he's asking why were Job's heart and spirit turned against God. So he's accusing Job of basically turning himself against God. And the point really is Job has not turned against God, but rather he's turned against his friend's traditional concept of God and how God deals with the sins of mankind. And so that's the constant battle that goes on here. In verse number 14, Job is trying to state that the issue is not whether man can be pure, clean, and righteous in God's sight, but whether Job's sins are such as merit the punishment he's now experiencing. If you look down at verse 14, he says, what is man that he could be pure, and he who is born of woman that he could be righteous? So Eliphaz asks that question, and Job never tries to state that a man can be pure, clean, or righteous. The point that Job keeps trying to make to Eliphaz and the others is that Job's sins are such as merit the punishment he is now experiencing, and something is not equating here. Job is suffering tremendous pain, tremendous punishment, and his question is, what have I done to deserve this? And that's what he keeps coming back to. It's interesting, Eliph is also in verses 15 and 16. He makes a reference to God himself, that God does not trust his holy ones. In verse 15 he says, if God puts no trust in his saints or holy ones, and in the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less mankind who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water. And so that's an interesting reference by Eliphaz, that God doesn't trust his holy ones. The heavens are not clean. How much less than mankind who lives on this earth and lives in sin. Could be some references. As we know, there's other passages that talk about when angels that left their habitation and there was war in heaven. I don't know, but Eliphaz's point is that mankind is very sinful. And Job, you're a man, and you're very sinful. And that's really what he's summarizing here. And when you get down to 15 and 16, if God has no trust in the holy ones, heaven's not clean, how much less man who drinks water like iniquity. And then in verses 17 through 35, he's going to state his theology as verified, quote-unquote, good housekeeping seal of approval by the ancients. And this good housekeeping seal of approval as verified by the ancients is the idea, and you're going to hear it over and over and over again, is that good men die happy deaths. And that's been contradicted by Job. Therefore, Eliphaz renews the theme that the wicked always have a miserable life and the wicked will always have a premature death. And that's just not the case. But that's his theology. If you're wicked, you're going to have a terrible life. If you're wicked, you're going to die early. And if you're a good man, you'll die a happy death and live to be a long age. And so that is his theology. And really the point comes down to verse 21 is these things have happened to Job. He's been diseased. He's had terrible and tremendous loss. Can only mean one thing to Eliphaz: Job is a wicked man. Job is sinful. And so this is a real danger when people get locked into their theology and they're not willing to open up and look at other possibilities. Any thoughts before we move to verse 22? Marvin.
I was just wondering, how did they think he was so wicked? It seemed like someone so wicked that they would know it. And it looks like to me so far, no evidence has showed that he has been wicked, mm-mm, but they're accusing him of it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is, but you got to remember that was their theological view, and it's rocking their whole paradigm, and so that's why they're taking pot shots. They're like, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and you're going to see later they start accusing him of robbing from widows and taking away from the poor. They start just making accusation after accusation. They really don't know, but it's their theology. I think Dave, I thought you saw your hand up.
Obeying your parents and listening to their counsel, you can have a longer life, that you would avoid a lot of other things. And we see that today. If you have one who's in Christ and they fall away, and then there's things that come into their lives, that protection, that seal from God is no longer there when they are erring in their ways, and so calamity does come. And you know, they're going to be disciplined. Things are going to happen. And so that stands true throughout the Scriptures. But at the same time, they're looking at Job and they're saying, whoa, look what's happened to you. Mm-hmm. Not only did you lose your family, all that you own, but you're stricken with these boils. And so surely there must be sin or something there that has caused this calamity to fall upon you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I can see where people would think that way.
And as Dave mentioned, I got two more hands up here, but there's a general rule, we all know this, that if you live a godly life and you follow God's word, as a general rule, you should have a peaceful life. But we also know Jesus said, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. And so sometimes bad things happen to good people. And that's a point that Job's going to start making. Okay, I think I saw Donna and then Bruce.
Mm-hmm. Live with this one belief. And so to accept something different would be to deny everything that ever thought.
It shakes their entire paradigm. That's right. Their whole world is turning upside down on this conversation. So.
Yeah, so.
And Bruce?
Well, later on we see in the Mosaic Law and in the New Testament that you have to have a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not brought forth any witnesses. They assume that they're the witness.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they can't say,
now it's good segue, because as we get into chapters 16 and 17, Job's going to say, no, God, you are my witness. And so he's going to actually call a witness in, which is God. So, but you're right, they didn't have any witness to verify anything Job had done anything wrong. And Job does maintain his integrity through all this. He says, I am innocent. I am innocent. I'm not a sinless man, but I haven't done anything heinous. And they're going to start really poking at some specific sins here in the next chapter or two. Verse 22, it talks about, let me flip over to the next slide. You guys remind me if I forget to flip this over, I get to talking. The word, the sword is used here in verse 22. It talks about he who does not believe that he will return from darkness, he watches for the sword. The sword here mentioned, most commentaries say it's either talking about the sword of the wronged getting vengeance, or it's the sword of God's own vengeance. And so Eliphaz makes reference to the wicked are always fearing the sword. In verses 23 and 24, it talks about the darkness of death, the fact that distress and anguish are always over the shoulders of a sinful man, and it's very much like facing a mighty king in battle and that turmoil you are facing when you know you're up against a mighty king. And so that distress that you would get from facing a mighty king, or that anguish you would get from going against a king that had a very powerful army, is the same distress and anguish that falls upon the sinful man. And in verse 25, he basically is accusing Job of shaking his fist at God. He says, he's talking about the evil man here. He says, for he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty. So because of arrogance and because of defiance against God, Eliphaz basically is accusing Job of, it's just like Job, it's like you're shaking your fist at the Almighty. And so that's his reference here. In verse 26, he talks about the stiff-necked and the stubborn of heart. These are the kind of people that would do this. And then he gets into the self-indulgence of the wicked, and he makes reference to the fact that their sides bulge with fat. Their faces are bulging with fat. And so the point here is it's a sign of opulence. And so this kind of evil man who had all this prosperity, he's going to come to poverty. He's going to come to ruin. And those that grow fat with self-indulgence, what happens is they see no more need for God. And that's kind of his accusation. Is Job, you got fat and you saw no more need for God. And so that's another accusation against Job. And then he starts wrapping up at the end of his speech here. He says, the wicked will fail in all their efforts to prosper. That's in verses 29 and 30. And then in 31 through 35, Eliphaz makes a reference to that the wicked are like palm trees, or are like grapes or olives that never bear any fruit, that never come to any fruitage. So they're like a fruit that withers away. And the real point at the end of his speech here, that if you want to take something away from all this, is Eliphaz just cannot admit the fact that bad people sometimes prosper. Okay, we see that in our society. Evil people, bad people, they will prosper. We see that in our society. And we also see in our society that sometimes good people will get cancer. Good people will get hit by a drunk driver. Bad things will happen to good people. And so the good sometimes will also suffer. We see that. And Job starts realizing this is the case that is happening to him. And what happens with Eliphaz is it doesn't fit his religion. It's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Because to Eliphaz, all who suffer are wicked. And Job suffers, therefore, equal sign, Job is wicked. And so that's just, he cannot escape that thought, that evil happens to bad people. And he just cannot get that out of his mind. And that's a common thing that's going to continue to happen throughout the duration of this, these three rounds and cycles. Okay, any other thoughts on chapter 15 before we move to chapter 16? Okay, Heather. I don't know. There's a couple times, we'll see it. He actually gets a little humorous here in chapter 17. He basically says, well, come back again when you've got some more thoughts. You know, it's almost condescending to them. I don't know other than Job, his integrity stayed with him. He was not going to just admit to some sin just to get them off his back. He was maintaining his integrity. He said, no, I haven't done some grievous thing. And he never ever, although there's times he accuses God of being the enemy, he never ever gives up on God, though. He never gives up his faith. Cherry Sue.
It's also that they're his three good friends. I mean, they sat for how many days?
Yeah, 7 days. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, the best thing that they would hope for is Job would admit to some sin and they would pray for him and repent and everything would be good again. And very good point. We need to not forget they came a long distance. They've known Job perhaps his whole life. And these were very wise men of the ancient times. So very interesting. Very good point. We need to forget that they did come and they sat with him for what was called the period of mourning for 7 days as Job sat there. All right, Job is going to respond now in verses 16 and 17. So he's going to have a two-chapter response, and he's going to basically reproach what he considers his friends who are very pitiless to him. And so I'll read this one, and then we'll make some comments. Then Job answered, chapter 16, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall words of wind, notice the reference to wind again, the Sirocco was mentioned earlier. Shall words of wind have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? I could also speak as you do if your soul were in my soul's place. In other words, he says, if we were to swap places, I could heap up words against you, and I could shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and I would comfort, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. Though I speak, my grief is not relieved, and though I remain silent, how am I eased? But now he's turning and looking at God now. He has worn me out. You have made desolate all my company. You have shriveled me up, and it is a witness against me. My leanness rises up against me and bears witness to my face. He tears me in his wrath and hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze at me. They gape at me with their mouth and strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me. God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he has shattered me. He has also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. He has set me up for his target. His archers surround me. He pierces my heart and does not pity. He pours out my gall on the ground, and he breaks me with the wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. I have sewn sackcloth over my skin and laid my head in the dust, and my face is flushed from weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. Although no violence is in my hands and my prayer is pure, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let my cry have no resting place. Show even now my witness is in heaven, or surely now my witness is in heaven, and my evidence is on high. My friends scorn me. My eyes pour out tears to God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleads for his neighbor. For when a few years are finished, I shall go the way of no return. So we've got 15 minutes to get to these last two chapters, but In verse 2 here, Job basically says, you guys are miserable comforters. Just give it up. Instead of comforting Job, let me get my thing flicked over here. They were tormenting him. They weren't doing any good. They weren't comforting him at all. And he turns this idea of the sirocco, that east wind, back on him. He says, will their vain, and the word literally translates, empty or windy words have no end. So he's actually using a poetic statement against them, because they accused him of being like the sirocco, the heated east wind. He says, you guys are full of empty wind, and where your words just have no end. The point that Job's making here is he doesn't deny that a man will reap what he sows, but he denies their charge that his suffering was punishment for some kind of severe sin. And that he continues to maintain that I have done nothing extremely sinful. And so, and then he goes on in verses 4 and 5, he talks the fact that he tells his friends, you know, it's easy to talk, guys. You know, it's easy to accuse. And so Job asks them, basically, how would you feel if we were to swap places here? And he literally is talking about that. If my soul took your soul's spot, if they were in his place, and how would they like it if he spoke to them like they were speaking to him? And he assures them that he wouldn't do that, that he would actually speak to them words of comfort instead of words of condescendence. So he reminds them that he wouldn't do that to them. In verses 6 through 14, Job speaks or forbears. He says he finds no relief in speech. He finds no relief in silence. So again, I think a reference to the severe pain he was in verse 6. He says, it doesn't matter whether I talk or I defend myself or I sit here in silence. He is under tremendous pain and suffering and agony. And just finds no relief whether he talks or whether he listens to them or sits in silence. In verse 7, this is probably Job's strongest accusation against God since back in chapter 9. You might remember in chapter 9 he makes kind of an accusation against God in chapter 9 verses 22, 23, and 24. Here Job charges that it must be God that is his enemy. And it must be God who is the cause of his troubles. And there's several references here. He makes several analogies to why he believes that. In verse 7, he says, God had made desolate all of his company, all of his family, all of his servants, all of his kinfolk, all of his friends. And in verse 8, he says, God has shriveled me up. Okay, just like a piece of dried fruit, he's been shriveled up. And then Job, in verses 9 through 14, describes God's vicious attack. And the analogies he makes here are rather interesting. In verses 9 and 10, he says that God is like a ferocious beast that's gnashing at him and coming at him. Verse 9 and 10 say, he gnashes at me, he tears at me with his wrath and hates me, he gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze on me. And so it's a description of like a ferocious beast. They gape at me with their mouth and strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me. So it's like a ferocious beast. In verse 11, he refers to God. The analogy is basically to a traitor. In verse 12, he talks about being grabbed by the neck and shaken almost to death. And that is a reference to a wrestler. In verse 13, he talks about the analogy here is to God is like an archer that is piercing him through. In verse 14, God is like a swordsman who's brought the sword to him. And basically what Job is saying here is to him, God, if it's not God, who else could it be? God is the assailant. It is God who has brought this to him. He doesn't know why, but it must be God. And so this, like I said, is one of the strongest accusations he makes against God in the book since earlier in chapter 9. But he does kind of wrap up this section by his reaction to all this as a person. And he says in verses 15, 16, 17, he says, I've put sackcloth on my skin. And of course, that was used to show grief, humility, or self-abasement. He talks about his horn. That really is referring to if a person talks about their horn, it's usually the horn of strength. It equates to physical strength or physical might. And he says his horn or his head is in the dust. It's severe humiliation, loss of pride, loss of honor. Then he refers to his face, that his face is so red, is red with weeping constantly, constant flowing tears, and that his eyelids show the shadow of death. It's a very, very deep darkness. So that's some of his references to what he feels like and his own body is looking like. In verse 17, he states that there is no wickedness or no violence in his hands, that his prayer is pure. And then in verse 18, very interesting point here, and it's something we can actually refer back to the book of Genesis on. Job prays that his blood not be covered up or his cry silenced. The uncovered blood of an innocent murdered person cries from the ground for vindication. Guess what that's a reference to? Genesis 4, when Cain slays Abel, and Abel's blood cried out from the ground because of its innocence and for vindication. And so Job here in verse 18 is praying that his innocent blood be not covered up by the dirt, that it's left exposed to view, and that way his cause will be vindicated. Job's fairly certain he's going to die soon, and so he's asking that his blood be not covered up. He wants his blood to be able to ask for vengeance. In verse 19, we get again another reference to Job is longing for an umpire. He wants that mediator, that umpire. And now, again, God earlier was the person who was the aggressor. Now God is, he hopes, the witness to all this. And so he goes back and forth between accusing God and then wanting God to be his witness. And Job knows he has a witness in heaven who knows the facts, but he doesn't know if it's God or another. He just knows that there's got to be a witness in heaven that knows the truth behind his life and behind all these events that have happened to him. And then finally in verse 20, he says his eyes had poured out tears to God. And in verses 21 and 22, it seems that Job is again asking that the God of grace and the God of love and the God of mercy maintains the cause of the righteous man alongside of the same God of wrath and judgment. And so again, Job makes a reference to the end of his life. So he goes back and forth between accusing God as being the aggressor and then asking God to be the witness. And so this is a continuous cycle. And like I said, this is the second time Job, of course, not knowing what we know from earlier in the book of all the things that have transpired, he says, if it's not God, who else could it be? Who else could have this power to do these things to him? Any thoughts before we go to the shorter chapter, Bruce?
Job said that they're sorry comforters. What could they have done if they were good comforters?
I guess what he keeps telling them is that he would have listened and he would have truly comforted them instead of... They spent their whole time accusing him of some heinous sin.
What could they have done? What acts would they have done? I'd say prayer.
Prayer.
And those would have shown them as good...
Maybe saying, you know, we believe you, that you didn't sin some grievous sin. Because they spent the whole time accusing. It wasn't anything along that line. Their orthodoxy was that Job had to be sinful. So, but I don't know, BJ, you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's really interesting. More so in 16 and 17 than any other place in Job, do you see language that portrays the language of Isaiah in 53 talking about the Messiah mm-hmm. and talking about being crushed, though he was not violent, and not opening up his mouth and making his grave with the wicked and being filled with the wicked. And all these things are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And it's interesting that Job keeps asking, why is this taking place? And, you know, the same reason that it happened to Jesus, because it was the will of the Lord to crush mm-hmm. him. And Job just can't wrap his mind around why. Why is it the will of the Lord to crush
exactly.
him? Yet that was the same, it's the same God that allowed his son to go through a much...
And the perfect example is who was the sinless of all, and yet... He suffered horrible things, and that was Christ. So, yeah, Jesus is the poster child for what's happened to Job. Okay, let's quickly read chapter 17. It's a short chapter. BG, can I get you to read that for me real quick? It's got 16 verses in it, and then we'll try to wrap this up in the next 5 or 6 minutes here.
My spirit is broken, my days are extinct, and the graveyard is ready for me. Surely there are mockers about me, and my eye dwells on their provocation. Lay down a pledge for me with yourself. Who is there who will put up security for me? Since you have closed their hearts to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. He who informs against his friends to get a share of their property, the eyes of his children will fail. He has made me a byword of the people, and I am the one before whom men spit. My eye has grown dim from vexation, and all of my members are like a shadow. The upright are appalled at this, and the innocent stirs himself against the godless. Yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. But you, come again, all of you, and I shall not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are broken off, the desires of my heart. They make night into day. The light, they say, is near to the darkness. If I hope for Sheol as my house, and if I make my bed in darkness, if I say to the pit, you are my father, and to the worm my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars of Sheol? Shall we descend together into the dust?
Okay. In verse 1, Job here, this is a whole chapter is kind of his prayer for relief. He talks about the fact that his breath in verse 1, and it may be referring to the word, the Hebrew word actually can mean wind, actual physical breath, his mind, or his spirit. If it's breath, like physical breath that he's speaking to, then what he's saying is his breath has a very foul and fetid odor like that of a dying person. If he's referring to breath being his spirit, then he's saying his inner life is being consumed and being destroyed. In either case, Job is saying the end of his days is near. His grave is ready for him. His friends' unfounded charges and false assumptions were a mockery in Job's ears, and that's because they kept defending their theological positions. In verse 3, Job turns his head and he's looking at God, and this is addressed to God. Here Job is asking God to give a pledge of assurance that God would put himself where Job is, that is, exchange places, and therefore guarantee a fair trial. And that's what he's really asking as he says, when he says, now put down a pledge for me with yourself, capital Y. He's talking to God here. In verses 4 and 5, Job says that God has concealed understanding from the hearts of his three friends, and that God will not exalt them, and that there's a reference to their children, to his three friends' children, and the reference is rather vague. Commentators struggle with this one, but it either means that their children's eyes would either fail or fail to see very well, or they would be blind and not see at all. But that's what the reference seems to be there in verses 4 and 5. Job talks about his three friends' children. In verses 6 through 10, Job is lamenting his condition. He says that his name was a byword for ridicule, verse 6. They spat in his face. We know who else that happened to Jesus himself. His eyes were dim due to constant weeping. His body members were wasting away from the disease. And then he talks about three kinds of men in verses 8 and 9. He talks about the upright men, that upright men would be stunned and amazed at what has happened to Job, because Job was a righteous man suffering without cause. He says that innocent men, the morally clean or ceremonial clean, would be roused, or they'd be incited to action against such treatment to a person. And then he talks about the third class of men, the righteous men. They would stay the course, they would be victorious, and would grow stronger in character and moral power. And Job is placing himself in that third category as being a righteous man. In verse 10, it appears that Job is taunting. This is what I referred to earlier. He almost says, okay, well, you're done for today. Come back tomorrow. Let's try again. He says in verse 10, but please, come back again, all of you, for I shall not find one wise man among you. So Job here appears to be taunting his friends to go ahead, bring on another attack of false charges, because you really don't know what you're talking about. Verses 11 and 12, Job sees death very close at hand, and he starts realizing that the desires of his heart as he walked on this earth were going to go unrealized. He wasn't going to have the desires that any of us would have as we live our life in this earth. And then he gets into the three ifs, and that's at the very end of the chapter are listed here. He sees this gloomy end in this shadowy existence of Sheol. He says, if I wait for my grave as my house, if I make my bed in the darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, you are my mother, and you are my sister. So Job here is and forgive me for forgetting to clicking that ahead. But the three ifs are listed here. He starts seeing a gloomy end to his life. And corruption, the word corruption there, he's talking about the decay of his body. And he talks about the worm. He's talking about the maggots that would feed on the body after the body has died. And then the final thoughts in verse 15 is Job is reminiscing and saying, well, where then is Job's hope? Where will his hope go? Will it go to the bars of Sheol? And will hope die with him when he dies? And so kind of a gloomy end to this section. But that is the beginning of round two with Eliphaz. So any final thoughts before we move on? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. Next week, it'll be a little bit shorter. We're going to read chapters 18 and 19. So just two chapters next time. So we'll get to spend a little more time in them. This is round two with Bildad. And then Job responds in chapter 19. And so we'll just have chapters 18 and 19 next Wednesday. So thank you for all your comments. Appreciate it.